Georgia's DBHDD is urging people to store and lock away all medications to prevent theft and keep them away from children and pets. Old medications can be disposed at Dropbox locations. Dropbox locations can be found at opioidresponse.info.
Welcome to Political Rewind. We've come to the Friday show at the end of a week which had some monumental developments in state and national politics, and even in the national political developments that occurred this week. Georgia was in the crosshairs at the center of much of what happened. It means we've got so much to talk about on today's show that I want to get right to our panel. It's Friday, which means today's the day that we have Patricia Murphy of the AJC, political reporter and the columnist who writes a Political Insider column on Wednesdays and Sundays in the newspaper, and who also oversees The Jolt, which gives you a great summary of politics every day at AJC.com. Patricia, lots to talk about. We should point out that you've already posted your Sunday column online, and it's an interview with Governor Kemp that you did with him just after he left the House chamber giving his State of the State speech yesterday.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I had intended to really talk mostly about the State of the State, but since that had just happened, we talked about lots of other things. We talked about his campaign coming up against David Perdue, running against Stacey Abrams shortly after that, really how he's positioning himself for the next year, and how he thinks his last 3 years have gone as governor. And so it was a really good conversation.
We are going to talk about a great deal of what happened yesterday at the Capitol, and include in that some of what he had to say to you. So I'm really happy you're with us today. Kurt Young is back with us. He, of course, is the chair of the political science department at Clark Atlanta University, teaches political science there as well. Kurt, Happy New Year. Haven't seen you since the start of the new year.
No, Happy New Year to you, Bill, and to all of our panelists today, and certainly to your listeners. I'm hoping 2022 is an exciting and productive year.
Thank you for being here. Mm-hmm. Renee Alegria, who is the CEO of Mundo Hispanico Digital, is with us as well. Before the show, Renee, I asked you how things have started for Mundo Hispanico in 2022. You said things are already off to a big start.
Yeah, you know, first of all, thanks for having me. Hello, everybody. Happy New Year. Happy Friday. Mundo Hispanico does what we're doing, and we're planning a really big year, you know, across the board, I think, throughout the nation, just reporting what we need to report for our Hispanic community and those and everything that affects us. And that's, it's what we do.
Well, you know, we're very glad that you could be with us today as well. All right, let's get right to the news. Patricia, on Tuesday now, President Biden, Vice President Harris come roaring into Atlanta. The president, you know, thumps his fist on a podium and says, I'm tired of intransigence in the Senate over voting rights reform bills, the two measures that had passed the House. We're going to get this done. And here it is, Friday, and it's already looking like it's not going to happen at all. Yesterday, the president emerged from a meeting with Senate Democrats on the Hill, including Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin, who have said they will not vote to remove the 60-vote barrier for getting legislation passed. Let's listen to just a little bit of what the president said.
I hope we can get this done, but I'm not sure. But one thing for certain, like every other major civil rights bill that came along, if we miss the first time, we can come back and try it a second time.
We thank CNN for sharing that soundbite with us. Patricia, this is just a devastating blow for the White House, for Biden personally. After all the noise, after all of the exhortations he made this week, and after having some voting rights leaders boycott his appearance here, he fails to get the job done. Talk about that.
Well, I think that is why some of those groups didn't want to be a part of the speech in Atlanta. I mean, it is a very weighty thing to come to Atlanta, to go to Clark Atlanta University, to visit the tombs and the crypts of Dr. King and Coretta Scott King, unless it really feels like it's going to make a difference. And I think that the voting rights groups, we were hearing out loud the frustration that we've been hearing quietly for many months now, that they feel like the Biden administration, frankly, owes Black voters everything, owes them the White House, owes them those two Senate seats because they just worked so hard to turn out and flip Georgia. And voting rights, quite frankly, was not the top priority of this White House. COVID is a reality. The White House has sped through other huge packages, $4 trillion of spending. They're trying to get another $3 trillion of spending through. So it has other priorities, and I think that voting rights group said, we heard from them, we don't feel like we've been a priority, and we don't want to be a part of this kind of dog and pony show. I think it has, you know, the president is trying to now at this point get credit for trying, but unless they change their strategy, there's not going to be results of this very high-profile effort.
Kurt, it is, of course, important to note that this failure, what appears to be a failure, according to the president's own accounting, comes just hours before the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., which is tomorrow, the anniversary of his birth, and Monday, of course, the celebration, the annual celebration of the King holiday. And voting rights advocates certainly are making note of that today.
Yeah, I think it was a missed opportunity. And I want to appreciate Patricia's reference to the glimmering image of Clark Atlanta University in the background of those photo ops that we have there. It was a missed opportunity. I think that the civil rights leaders of various organizations that Patricia mentioned a moment ago were not late to this. They've been raising this question very early on in the administration. This is not something that snuck up on the administration. They knew that there was discontent in the ranks and files. And in many ways, the administration put itself in a position where it had no choice but to come to Atlanta and to come out in front of the holiday, the celebration next week. It is no coincidence that it came at this particular point in this particular timing. And to get out in front of what we knew would come on Monday, which is going to be not just this reflection on Martin Luther King, but that image of King standing there with LBJ signing these important civil rights legislations, right? We're going to see those images across the internet and social media and hopefully throughout national media. But what it does now, and I guess just looking at this through the lens of pure politics, what it does, though, is that it gives the administration the opportunity to say that we are fighting this fight. He banged the podium and said, I'm tired of being quiet. And that sometimes sends a message of the administration fighting the good fight, Bill.
Go ahead.
Just one last point. However, what I think it does, though, is that it kind of shed light on where we knew Biden was all along. He's an institutionalist. He never took a position that he would push back against the filibuster. And so in many ways, what's coming out of Sinema's camp and Manchin's camp, in essence, puts the Biden administration where it prefers to be, which is to find other types of strategies to make these bills legislation.
Renee, we should point out, of course, that the anger over the inability of Democrats, the president, to pass either the John Lewis voting rights bill or the other measure, which has a lot more detailed ways in which the federal government would have some regulatory powers over state elections. It's one-sided anger. These are Democrats who want this measure. If you talk to a Republican, and when Biden says Georgia's the center of voter suppression with its new voting law, we should be careful to say that's a Democrat's take on it. Republicans are rejoicing that there isn't going to be a federal takeover of, as they describe it, of the elections in states like Georgia. And of course, Georgia Republicans say, you know, their standard line is the new laws make it easier to vote, harder to cheat. So we do want to point out the anger is pretty one-sided here.
Yeah, as we would say at Mundo Hispanico, Dios mío, this is a difficult and shaky few days to be a Democrat. Sinema, Manchin, there was no surprise that they're ultimately not going to change or vote to alter the filibuster in any way. They've said it all along. I think, so many Democrats, the Biden administration hoped, he made that last pitch effort to try. There you go. Obviously, I think this is frustrating for progressives, that these two Democrats are blocking almost all of Biden's agenda right before midterms that could cost them the House, the Senate, and some folks, if we're being dramatic, could possibly put democracy itself in question with the voter rights legislation. I do think, and this is the point you made, that the historical resonance of the timing here with Martin Luther King's birthday and celebration just really makes everything a lot more poignant, And I do think, though, that anger moves people to the polls. And, if the Democrat rank and file are poised to really make a difference, maybe this is the trigger that they're going to need to get their voters en masse to the polls.
I think there's some hesitation on the part of some in the Biden administration to really push these two senators too far, because there is such a thing as senators switching parties in a 50-50 Senate. Mm-hmm. And we saw that happen with Jim Jeffords. And when Jim Jeffords flipped from Republican to caucus with the Democrats, it flipped the control of every Senate chairmanship. And any filibuster rule changes that Democrats make today could have the opposite effect if Republicans pick up the Senate by one vote, 10 months from now. And so I think they're just there is just this incredible rock and a hard place. But the longer you go on in an administration, the harder it is to move big legislation like this. And so the question now is, do they trim this down to something that could pass? Do they wait until the election and hope it goes better than expected? I think it's very hard to see a path forward for this, but it's never over until it's over. So we can't declare it dead. There could be a compromise out there somewhere, but they really have their work cut out for them.
So, Kurt, Patricia suggests that maybe if you want to try to move forward, if you're Democrats in Washington, you look at whether there are places to trim the measure. And there are some that don't relate specifically to counteracting some of the state election laws that have been passed in places like Georgia. One of them being, for instance, campaign finance reform. I mean, mm-hmm. arguably campaign finance reform is an important matter, but it also is the sort of thing that you could pull out of a much more focused voting rights bill, perhaps, and hope to get some progress on moving forward on this. Nevertheless, you've still got that 60 vote need in the Senate to pass a measure, and I'm not sure you can trim out everything except the most basic details and still get any Republicans on board.
No, I think you make a good point, and that kind of remedy, that kind of streamlining is something that can possibly appeal to a Sinema and a Manchin and others who may be sort of on the fence in supporting this legislation. However, there's a problem. The problem is that the concrete political reality right now is that those who are mobilized on the Democratic side, progressive, moderates, African-Americans, women, whatever the case may be, they are on the train of voter protection. They are on the train mobilizing around the question of protecting the right, the fundamental right of Americans to exercise the franchise of the vote. And it will take an act of political savviness that I'm not sure is there to project a connection between campaign finance reform and protecting the fundamental right to vote. Now, of course, we know that there's a relationship there, But when we look to see who's mobilizing and what has to happen, if this is the reality that Renee has painted and Patricia has painted that we're dealing with, it's going to have to be a massive turnout. The only option at the Democratic disposal is a massive turnout to overwhelm these policies. But even that strategy would take multiple terms because of the number of senators that will be up for election and up to seats that will be up for change in a given cycle. And so it is an immediate strategy, but it's also a long-term strategy that can only really be sustained if it's speaking the language that's mobilizing folks on the ground.
I do want to bring up, this is Renee, I do want to bring up the opportunity that this lays bare locally. Kurt used the word mobilize. You know, there is now a vacuum of who is going to take the mantle of leadership to drive this issue into the hearts of voters. Is it going to be Stacey Abrams? She seems to be the one that's, you know, poised to do so. This could be her big, big issue, given the fallout of this and how it affects Georgians. So it is going to be very interesting to see how she deals with this and how she galvanizes, mobilizes, and you know, plots the future of the coming year.
Patricia, speaking of Stacey Abrams, we all got an interesting statement from the Abrams gubernatorial campaign saying that there have been rumors, unfounded and unfair rumors about Stacey Abrams not attending the Biden speech because of a conflict of scheduling. And they condemned people who pointed out that she wasn't going to be at the speech. But the fact of the matter is, the statement was an odd statement. It said Stacey Abrams had no expectation she'd be invited to be with the president and vice president. Well, considering that Stacey Abrams is the most visible spokesperson for voting rights in the country today, that seemed like an odd statement. And it does feel like the Abrams campaign is still kind of not willing to talk about why she decided not to be there.
Yeah, she said that she had a private commitment that she couldn't change and did not go into any more detail. That leads to widespread speculation and led to even more speculation in the days and the moments leading up to the event. The reality is that the Biden administration did not plan this long in advance, didn't reach out to the people you think they might reach out to before they have a huge event like this. What the Abrams camp was willing to say was that the reporting in the New York Times that said that she had rejected this offer because mm-hmm. she was not invited to speak was just totally wrong. If you sort of think about her role with the administration, she was considered as a vice presidential candidate. It's hard to imagine that she wouldn't have been offered a speaking slot. She is the champion for this issue nationwide. The president would want her on that podium no matter when and where the event was. Because she has not been more detailed in her explanation, I think it has, though, led to a lot of speculation and assumptions that she just doesn't want to be on the same stage as the president when his poll numbers are hovering below 40%. The Abrams camp says that's just not the case.
So, Patricia, while we've got the ball in your court, I'd like to hear your thoughts on what Renee just suggested, and really Kurt did as well in talking about this may mobilize voters. This does give Stacey Abrams another opportunity to once again show her fierce commitment to voting rights as a candidate for governor, and with Governor Kemp and others, Republicans in the legislature celebrating the fact that no federal legislation has happened yet, it's going to be great fodder for her campaign, isn't it?
Well, and that really was one of her primary issues in 2018,
right,
also, when Governor Kemp was the Secretary of State. I would almost say it was her primary issue, both the way that she said he had operated in the Secretary of State's office, staying on in that post during the election. It became in itself a nationwide issue. What is just incredible how these events are unfolding is that elections are going to be, I think, the most important issue to Renee's point, in 2022 here in Georgia, if you just look back to a year ago at the General Assembly, you see the emotion, just the raw emotion that this issue unleashes among Democratic voters, and especially for Black voters, it's not a distant memory when voter suppression was their everyday existence. Suppression in all forms was their everyday existence here in Georgia. So the debate in the General Assembly, I think, will essentially unfold again in 2022, and then you cannot take Donald Trump's shadow out of this on the Republican side. Mm. Republicans are fighting about the elections all over again. And so we'll continue to hear about that on the Republican side. And Donald Trump attacking Brian Kemp for not doing enough in Georgia's elections bill. So we will be hearing about this day in and day out.
Absolutely. Renee, it is of note that, and we're going to talk next about Governor Kemp's State of the State speech and how he laid out a social policy agenda that is red meat for his base. But it is notable that one thing that the governor did say, and Patricia, he may have told you this in your interview too, although I might be confusing it with other reporting I've read, but Renee, the governor does not want to see new election bills introduced in the General Assembly this session. We've already got a couple from candidates for lieutenant governor over on the Senate side, an elimination of drop boxes, getting rid of the electronic voting machines, going to paper ballots. We're likely to see other bills come along as well. But Governor Kemp has already said, I'm happy. Oh, I know he told Patricia this. I'm happy with the bills that we passed last session. He thinks SB 202 does enough, as he would say, to secure honest elections and give everyone an equal chance to vote. So, Renee, it's interesting. He doesn't want to take up that cause this time around.
No. He's out there spending money like a Democrat, right? So that's what he's doing. I think it's timing is everything with issues like we just like Patricia just pointed out with Stacey Abrams and her not attending Biden's speech. I feel like Kemp is selecting very tactically what he's going to align himself with and not. I do think that he understands the changing nature of the Georgian voter, and it's almost like he's looking past Purdue at this point, and he's isolating the real Georgian out there, and he's saying, okay, I don't need to deal with election laws because we already have what those on the books. Instead, I'm going to give millions of dollars to education.
Bill, I was just saying a moment ago how tricky it's going to be to strike the balance between a massive voter turnout, particularly comprised of African-American voters and women and others, but certainly of those two demographics, and its impact on the national political scene, right, particularly as it relates to the Senate. However, if the opposite is the case in the state of Georgia, if there is such a massive turnout, it will register on the Richter scale, the political Richter scale in the state of Georgia. And you need look no further than what Patricia just mentioned, which was the very close nature of the race between for governor last term. And so those issues haven't changed. In fact, what you may see, as we've been discussing, I guess, about a year now, Bill, right, this purpling of the state of Georgia, right, that is not necessarily a red state, certainly not a blue state yet. But it's increasingly shifting, and I think Renee just said it, the demographics are shifting. So if there is such a flood, such a mobilization effort that turns out the vote in the state of Georgia, I think it would resonate differently in the state of Georgia than perhaps on the national scene, which, of course, makes Kemp, if anything, he's politically savvy, and he knows that he does not want to pour any fuel on the fire that would make this a campaign issue, and it will not go away. I think Patricia has said it best. It's not going away. And I think that it is going to be one of the most important platforms in Abrams' campaign to stand firm on protecting these rights.
All right. I've got to get to our first break of the show. Mm-hmm. As I do, I should point out that our frequent panelist, Alan Abramowitz, who is one of the leading political analysts in the state, has been saying ever since SB 202 was passed that he believes it's going to end up, and Kurt Young basically seconding this, is going to end up turning out Democrats in bigger numbers than ever before. We'll watch to see if that's the case or not. So let's get to a break. When we come back, let's talk about the Kemp agenda, which he started laying out in pretty great detail yesterday. You're listening to Political Rewind. You know, this is absolutely one of those weeks when political news is coming at us so fast and furious that it's hard to keep up with everything that's going on. I know that's one of the reasons you listen to our show, to Political Rewind, and I'm certainly grateful that you do. But as I've mentioned a couple times this week, you can now also keep up with the headlines by subscribing to the Political Rewind newsletter, which will come to your inbox every Wednesday. And I'll be looking to feature what I think are the top stories. Well, I'll be assisted by Riley Bunch, by Stephen Fowler, and others in our newsroom. So I hope you'll subscribe. You can do it by going to gpb.org/newsletters, and you'll find us there. We're joined today by Kurt Young, Clark Atlanta University, Renee Alegria, Mundo Hispanico Digital, and, of course, Patricia Murphy, AJC political columnist and reporter. Patricia, I think the starting point for a conversation about the governor's state of the state yesterday, from my point of view, given that, like you, I've heard so many of these over the decades, it was an efficient speech. It was straightforward. He certainly didn't attempt to weave in poetic references and in some ways give a flowery speech that appreciators of literature might like. He just laid out an agenda in a pretty straightforward way in about 35 minutes. And as Renee Alegria has already said, the starting point was he's got a lot of money and surplus funds to dole out right now.
I completely agree with you. It was, you know, I think the speech was ever like, okay, that was just Brand Kemp in a speech. That was very straightforward. There was no poetry. It was practically wearing cowboy boots, which he does. It was just very, very specific to what he plans to do in the next year. And when you look at what he plans to do, especially in this legislative session, I think you really see the DNA of a governor who has a Republican primary in May, and if that goes well, a very strong Democratic challenge in November. Now, that's essentially also the nature of the state that he's been governing for the last 3 years. It's not exactly as Kurt said, it's not a red state, it's not a blue state. So what he has laid out is an enormous amount of spending on public education. He did one of the very few sort of flourishes he had in the speech was to talk about the heroic efforts day in and day out of teachers during COVID. He also had praise for school bus drivers and school nurses, and he'll have bonuses for them as well. And a $5,000 salary increase for state workers. Many of those state workers will never vote for Brian Kemp, but those are broadly popular issues for people who rely on those government workers in their communities, large and small. There was also a lot of conservative red meat that conservatives, Trump supporters in particular, will be looking for. They'll be looking for results coming out of this session. And so I think there were a few omissions, which we can talk about later, but what I saw were really deliverables to take into these elections. He may have done these otherwise. It's consistent with the policies he's had, but especially the spending. I think that does speak to a governor who is doing things that he hopes are going to win over Georgians.
Let me ask you another quick question and then get Kurt and Renee into the conversation. I mentioned on the show yesterday in talking about his spending plans that although Governor Kemp has you know, been very firm in saying he wants these things, Speaker Ralston has urged that we need to be frugal and cautious in our spending. And I suggested that maybe Ralston wasn't going to get on board with some of these spending plans. But Patricia, things like an income tax refund, things like putting money back into schools at K through 12 and higher education, those are going to be issues that are going to be hard. The Speaker's not going to ask his members to vote against things like that.
Well, so Brian Kemp and Speaker Ralston are allies, and they typically tend to be on the same page politically. And so it would be impossible to think they didn't discuss those items in particular ahead of time. Is this doable? What do you think? Do you think the caucus is going to go along with it? And so those are things I think that will not have a hard time passing this legislature. I think when Ralston talks about being frugal, that is to the concept of totally eliminating the state income tax, which is what David Perdue has proposed.
Yeah.
Other members will certainly pitch that in a bill or two in this session. But I think Ralston, and then in my interview with Kemp, they both laid out what they call just responsible budgeting. The only reason they can have tax cuts is because they didn't spend a whole lot in the past, in particularly Kemp's description. So we'll have to see what they do with it going forward.
So, Kurt, Patricia points out that there are going to be people who will receive the benefits of what Kemp is proposing, state employees with their raises, who will never vote for him. On the other hand, he had red meat for his base in his speech and certainly in his broader agenda as well. Among those things, well, the thing he really focused on in a big, big way was critical race theory. He doesn't want it taught in Georgia schools. We don't think it is being taught, at least that formal discipline is being taught in Georgia schools. But like Republicans in many races around the country, he's convinced that's going to be a big issue for his base.
A couple points. First, it just continues to just amaze me how distorted, oversimplified, and just outright manipulated this discussion on critical race theory is coming from the leadership and throughout the nation. Critical race theory is a framework. It's a theoretical framework. And you're right, though it has not been implemented in K through 12, and I teach at the college level, you may find a professor who will include it on his or her syllabus, but it's not a framework that's established as a current driving force in American education. So, but what does it provide? It provides what we saw unfold in Virginia with the victory of Governor Youngkin. It provides an instrument to tap into one of the most important forces in American politics, and that is the extent to which political power is manifest in the context of groups, human groups. And one of the most important groupings that pursue political power in American society is groups aligned according to race. It is one of the fundamental dynamics of American society. And the argument here becomes, if the issue does not exist in any real and practical terms, what is the political benefit of politicizing this issue? It is to exactly accomplish what critical race theory points out, which is the maintenance of a race in the context of the American body politic, supported by history, supported by public policy, not necessarily by racists walking around with whites only or blacks only shirts, T-shirts on. It's a manifestation of the concrete realities of race in American society. And so what we're seeing here is an effort to strategically utilize public policy as a way of suppressing that conversation, which is exactly what Chris Grace is saying to be the problem here, right? And so, but I don't want to drift too far and have a discussion about my frustrations around this dialogue. It is indeed being politicized in Georgia politics to the same way that we saw it being politicized across the country and certainly in Virginia.
Renee, let's listen to how Kemp framed his argument against critical race theory in his speech yesterday and then talk about it on the other side.
Marty and I are also concerned about what we're seeing across the country. From the classroom to the ball field, there are those who want to divide our kids along political lines, push partisan agendas, and indoctrinate students from all walks of life. This is wrong, it's dangerous, and as long as I'm governor, it will not take root in our state. That's why I'm looking forward to working with the members of the General Assembly this legislative session to protect our students from divisive ideologies like critical race theory that pits kids against each other.
Renee?
It's astounding. How critical race theory has morphed into fact. It is not taught in schools. There's no public education syllabus that has critical race theory as part of it. But it's ruled out as a, as this insidious talking point that, and I say insidious because I think that it's dangerous. You know, it's leading to books being banned. It's you know, teachers are afraid of being sued, fired, losing their teacher's license just because they're afraid of saying the wrong thing. You know, Kent is using this CRT, excuse me. And it's, of course, reminiscent of Glenn Youngkin's campaign in Virginia. You know, Youngkin did really well with middle-class white moms by villainizing Toni Morrison. I mean, that will that play in Georgia? I don't think it would, but that's what Kemp's betting on.
Bill, another social issue, sort of very hot button, controversial issue that the governor didn't name specifically, but did sort of give reference to. He talked about ensuring fairness in high school sports.
Yeah.
We expect that to be a bill to ban transgender athletes from competing in sports that are not consistent with their gender at birth. That is a bill that did come up last year, but it just didn't go anywhere. I think it was perceived as being way too conservative, way too hot. We definitely think that will come up this year. And it sounds like, depending on what the legislation looks like, it could have the governor's support. One item that he did not address really at all, though, that I think would have been very popular, but I think with, you know, David Perdue in the race, he just can't go there. And that is dealing with Medicaid expansion. We hear all the time from people who are uninsured, cannot afford premiums through Obamacare, hundreds of thousands of Georgians working but not covered by insurance. Medicaid expansion would really address that, but Governor Kemp really didn't address the Medicaid gap at all. And it's something that I think will be one issue that Stacey Abrams will absolutely be campaigning on. She has talked about paying bills of Georgians who couldn't pay their own hospital bills. So I think that's going to be an issue that was not addressed yesterday, but will be very front and center in the election.
So Patricia makes a good point, Renee, which is to suggest that certainly, especially the hot button issues, the social issues that Kemp is promoting are aimed at beating David Perdue in a primary. That is not necessarily the place to be if he gets past David Perdue and faces Stacey Abrams in a general election. It remains to be seen how many Georgia voters out there who are not dyed-in-the-wool, Republicans are going to embrace some of these things he's promoting.
Well, it just goes to show what a tough spot he's in. You know, I mean, he's got to run to the right and Perdue flanking him, and then he's got to run to the left because Abrams is waiting for him there. You know, with the plan, and you know, once Perdue announced, everyone, you know, thought, okay, let's see how this is going to roll out, and. Well, we're watching it play out. We're watching him, you know, invest in education. We're watching him, you know, Patricia pointed out the brevity of his speech, right? I mean, he wants to keep it tight. He wants to keep it to just facts so that he can say in the general election, this is what we invested in. This is what we spent for Georgians. But not really, you know, frame that for the primary with Perdue. I do think that this is just all of critical race theory, and you know, it's just a kind of a stark reminder of the major changes that this country is going through. You know, generationally, you see one generation just living a completely different universe than what has gone before them, and that, you know, that Gen Z, you know, they vote. Be, you know, watch out.
Kurt, that is a really, really pertinent point to make. And I'd love to hear you comment on it before we have to get to our final break.
Yeah, I mean, I was, as Renee was talking, I was thinking that's such an important point. And also, Renee, not only the previous generation, but the different lived experience of groups who are part of the same generation, right? On the extent to which they look at the political reality and see two totally different realities. And that makes sense to me in the context of the other, and I think you mentioned it yourself, the other major balancing act that Trump, Kemp has to balance. That is indeed the fact that this is a Republican Party that's pretty much still led by the former president, Donald Trump. His confrontation with Perdue is essentially a confrontation with Donald Trump. And we have yet to see if Donald Trump's endorsement power is still as such as it has been in the past. I think there's signals that it's waning. But nonetheless, the other states where it may be waning aren't Georgia. And Georgia could be a very, very different kind of reality, and Kemp has to deal with that Trump voice in that context.
Before we do have to take a break, one last question for you, Patricia, or comment, really, observation. Mm-hmm. When I read your column with Governor Kemp, when you talked with him about the Perdue race, the impression I came away with is that the governor, at the very least, wants to portray himself as calm and confident about the outcome of this primary. Yes?
You know, I was, frankly, really, it really struck me how incredibly relaxed he was yesterday. I certainly in our political coverage, we know what he's facing. His, grassroots Republicans around the state are not relaxed. People supporting Brian Kemp are not relaxed. They are kind of freaking out, actually. But Brian Kemp really seems at peace with what he's done so far. And, not that he's not worried. He's very competitive. He was not nice about David Perdue. He really said, you know, anybody who's playing politics, it's David Perdue. The only reason we can even have a tax cut is because of what I did. Ask David Perdue how he's going to pay for that thing. You know, it's not that he's not competitive, but he was just very relaxed. And I was kind of surprised.
By the way, I wish I had a transcript of the remarks in front of me. But when Speaker Ralston introduced Kemp yesterday, he came as close to a formal endorsement of the governor for re-election as you could possibly ask for, didn't he, Patricia?
Absolutely, absolutely. He was, you know, there is this David Perdue challenge out there. There is Donald Trump watching what everybody does or getting reports of it. And Speaker Ralston said, I'm so proud of this governor. Yeah. This governor has led this state in a way nobody else could and nobody else will. You know, really, we know who. It sure sounded like we know who Ralston is going to vote for.
All right. Let's do this. I'm late for our final break. Let's get to it. When we come back, we got to talk about another Biden defeat this week. That was in the United States Supreme Court. You're listening to Political Rewind. Patricia Murphy, I want to get to the Supreme Court and their decision on the vaccine mandate for big businesses in a second here. But real quickly, we have an interesting story that developed in the state Senate yesterday that I want to get a quick response from you on. Jeff Duncan, Lieutenant Governor, pretty well put a dagger in the heart of the Buckhead City movement on the Senate side. Who did he assign to take up the measure that would allow voters the chance to vote for a city of Buckhead?
Well, he's put that effort in the hands of State Senator Lester Jackson, who's a Democrat from Savannah.
And all of the members of that Urban Affairs Committee are Democrats who have opposed this move all along.
Yes, exactly. One Democrat said, it's not dead, but it's in a body bag. And we're like, well, that almost sounds worse. It's not a complete roadblock, but it's a very high-speed bump, I would say. Yeah. There will be a House bill, but this is not a good opening act for the Buckhead City effort.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, let's, Patricia, talk about the Supreme Court. We all know at this point the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that the Biden mandate to have employees of companies with over 100 people either have them vaccinated or weekly tests to prove that they're not positive. It was a blow to the administration. The only comfort they got was the Supreme Court said their mandate for healthcare workers could move forward. All in all, but here's what I want to ask you about this, Patricia. It strikes me that in some ways, this makes the decision-making for big businesses even more difficult. You know, at least if they had the mandate, they'd say, well, the government's making us do this. Now they got to figure it all out on their own.
That's right. And I think a number of big businesses appreciated having just, frankly, the political cover of saying, well, hey, you can't, don't blame us. You have to get vaccinated because the federal government said so. It is a big blow to this administration, not just on the merits, which are very real, but I think it's starting to create this question in people's minds, you know, is it possible that Joe Biden is a good person but not a very good president? It doesn't seem like they've got everything buttoned up right now. And they've got had a string of defeats here in the last couple of days.
Yeah, we're going to, on another show, have a larger conversation about how the Biden administration is staging each of the efforts they're trying to make to pass their agenda in Congress or to get their messaging out to the American people. We'll save that for a different show. But, Kurt, I want to mention something. You know, Georgia, of course, has been deeply involved in these lawsuits opposing all of the vaccine mandates that the Biden administration has put forward. And I want to read you a quote from Attorney General Chris Carr yesterday. He said this: this mandate was nothing more than an illegal power grab operating under the guise of workplace safety. Now, here's why I'm asking about that, Kurt. Mm-hmm. I understand that state governments, especially now in this case, Republican state governments, want to maintain a level of control without interference from the feds. You know, you could say, fine, go ahead, see how far you get in courts with that sort of thing. But do we really believe that Chris Carr thinks that this is a power grab by a power-hungry administration rather than an effort to protect people against COVID? That strikes me as a purely political statement that doesn't do him justice in terms of the work he's trying to get accomplished.
Well, you know, the local politics or the state politics are going to be microcosms of national politics. And the national tone has been set before the Biden administration arrived, which was that this pandemic was politicized in America. It was politicized in ways that we hadn't seen, or less prominent, less consequential issues. This might have been politicized from the very beginning. And not only has the issue been politicized, of course, we have already been discussing for much of the time how the nature of the politicizing of the American political process in general, beyond any particular policy issue. And so what you see in resonating in the state of Georgia is a reflection of what's happening nationally around this issue. Now you add to that one final ingredient, and that is the extent to which there's this lack of polity in the American political system and discourse right now. And it's certainly occurring at the state level. And I don't want to continue to make a monster out of Donald Trump, but his shadow is still there. And so in many ways, it will reflect in the way that we even talk about politics among state political leaders.
You know what I thought was very interesting, and it was even made so much more so. I read this piece in The Nation. I forget the name of the journalist. I should know that. But and they pointed out that that the vaccinated boosted and remote working justices, okay, are not anti-vax, but they're more anti-labor. And it was an interesting way to frame this, you know, that they struck down the part of laws that protect workers or would inconvenience and cost employers money. And what are the broad effects of that weaving its way down through courts as the Supreme Court is, you know, their decisions hold sway in every court around the country. You know, they vaccines are required in schools, healthcare workers. The court did uphold, and this is something for the Biden administration, they did uphold vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. Yeah. Just not large employers like say the meatpacking plants or the grocery stores, which had huge numbers of outbreaks and deaths at the beginning of the pandemic. They forgot that, right? And I think their decision, unfortunately, leaves a patchwork of state and local vaccine and testing policies that the lowest paid, most vulnerable, and hardest hit by the virus, they can't go remote, you know. So it's troubling.
Yeah, the minority justices, in their opinion, said the court is trying to take the place of public health officials in deciding what's necessary to protect people. Patricia, in closing the show today, the reason I mentioned the Chris Carr comment is it seems that this has been a week of political hyperbole on both sides of the aisle that has not done much to advance the real agenda, the needs of the people of this country. So Chris Carr says this is an illegal power grab, not an effort to help protect people. On the other hand, you have Democrats accusing those who oppose the voting rights bills of being like Bull Connor, like George Wallace, which is hyperbolic in its own way and just makes us understand over and over that partisan politics prevails over reason in almost everything we talk about these days.
Yeah, you know, and that's disappointing. Disappointing as a political reporter who got into this because I really do have so much respect for, you know, the people who try and do it right.
Exactly.
It's sad. If you leave Atlanta and Washington and get around the state, you'll see less of it, which makes me feel good.
Well, thank you so much for those last comments, because that's how I feel too, Patricia. I love talking about policy and how politicians work together to accomplish agendas, and did that for most of my career. And it is dispiriting to be at the place we are today. But on Political Rewind, we'll continue to have the smartest conversations we can and hope that it makes some difference to people out there who are listening to us. So, Patricia Murphy, we'll post a link to your column today with Brian Kemp. Thank you, Renee Alegria, Kurt Young. It's been a real pleasure to have you here for a terrific conversation today at the end of an intense week in politics. As we leave you, my thanks, as always, to our engineer, Jesse Neiswanger, to our producer, Sam Burmes-Dawes, to our senior producer, Natalie Mendenhall. Thank you for the work you do every day to make Political Rewind better. We're out of time. We're back again on Monday. In the meantime, please take care. Stay healthy. Yes, wear your mask and go get that booster that you've been putting off for a while now. See you all next week.